January 11th, 1984. Ypsilanti, Michigan. Two armed men enter a real estate and insurance office before one of them fires a shot into the neck of the 47-year-old owner, Jack Brown. The assailants then lock the office's other employees in the bathroom before fleeing the scene, and Jack dies in the hospital several hours later. Prior to his death, Jack had hinted that he might be involved in something which led to his murder, but the perpetrators are not identified, and the crime is never solved. After that, the trail went cold. Hello, everyone, and welcome to our latest episode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm your host, Robin Warder, and today we're going to be exploring a baffling cold case which was featured on Unsolved Mysteries, the 1984 murder of Jack Brown. This is the bizarre story of a businessman who ran a real estate and insurance office before two armed men showed up at his workplace in the middle of the day and killed him. In fact, one of the men said, quote, "You think you're pretty smart, don't you?" before firing the fatal shot into Jack's neck. Even though there were three other employees in the office at that time who could identify the two perpetrators, they were all left unharmed, so it seemed clear that Jack was deliberately targeted and the crime resembled a professional hit. However, a search of Jack's background turned up nothing which could shed any light into why anyone would want to murder him in such a brazen fashion, though in the weeks prior to his death, it appeared that something was bothering Jack, and he made some cryptic comments to suggest that he might have known incriminating information about important, powerful people. Even though there is not a ton of information available about this case online, you will find quite a bit of unsubstantiated rumors about why Jack was killed, which I'll be addressing later on. But since the date after this episode's release happens to be the 40th anniversary of the crime, I thought now would be a good time to cover it. Also, once I'm done discussing the Jack Brown murder, I'm going to spend a few moments talking about another unsolved shooting which occurred in a real estate office 5 months earlier, but this particular case took place in Houston, Texas, and three female real estate agents were the victims: 54-year-old Elizabeth Shoemate, 60-year-old Frances Ivy, and 46-year-old Joanne Brown. The two cases aren't connected, but the name Joanne Brown is a unique coincidence between them, as Jack Brown was married twice, and his wives just happened to be named Joe and Ann. Anyway, before we get started, just a quick reminder that The Trail Went Cold is a weekly podcast, which is currently available for download on several platforms, including Apple Podcasts and Spotify. So if you like this podcast, be sure to subscribe to it, and please leave us a rating or review on any of those sites to help spread the word and garner us more exposure. The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so if you would like to learn how to support the show, please visit our page at patreon.com/thetrailwentcold. For as little as $1 a month, you can garner access to exclusive rewards, including stickers and thank you cards, early access to episodes, and bonus content, as our Patreon page currently has over 60 exclusive bonus episodes in our archives, which are not available on a regular feed. So with all that out of the way, let us now start off by exploring the death of Jack Brown. Our story begins in 1984 in Ypsilanti, Michigan, a town located in Washtenaw County, which borders Ann Arbor, and had a population of around 24,000 at that time. Our central figure is 47-year-old Jack Brown, a local businessman who is known for being an active member of the community as part of the local Chamber of Commerce and the Rotary Club. While he was originally born in Piggott, Arkansas, Jack has lived in Ypsilanti for most of his life. He has three sons and a daughter with his first wife, Jo Greenstreet Brown, but after their 20-year marriage ended in divorce in 1976, Jack eventually got remarried to his second wife, Ann Brown, who was a nurse at the University of Michigan Hospital. For the past 17 years, Jack has worked in the real estate and insurance office, Eamon and Greenstreet, which is located on West Michigan Avenue. Even though the business had been owned by his ex-wife's family for over 5 decades, Jack agreed to buy it from his former father-in-law in 1979. Well, on the morning of Wednesday, January the 11th, Jack showed up at Eamon and Greenstreet for a seemingly routine workday when two suspicious men came in through the front door at 11:10 a.m. One of them was described as being between 35 to 40 years old and was around 6 feet tall and 200 pounds with blonde hair and was dressed in a beige jacket and light-colored pants. The other man was described as being approximately 50 years old with an exceptionally wrinkled face and was around 5'10" and 160 pounds with dark hair and brown eyes, and he was wearing coveralls and a blue knit stocking cap. Three other employees besides Jack were working at the building that morning, but the older man pulled out a handgun to keep them at bay, while the younger man headed towards Jack's office with a .38 caliber revolver in his hand. At the time, Jack was speaking on the phone with his son Jackie, who was in the hospital for an operation, but after seeing the two men, Jack said, quote, "We have trouble here," before hanging up. When the gunman appeared in Jack's doorway, he said, quote, "You think you're pretty smart, don't you?" Jack then replied, quote, "Well, maybe," before the gunman suddenly fired off a shot into Jack's neck, severing an artery. After Jack fell to the floor, the two men took the three other employees to the back of the office and locked them inside the bathroom. Shortly thereafter, the employees heard a second gunshot, and while they feared they would be killed too, the gunman soon fled the office and left them unharmed. It would later turn out that the second shot had been fired into the ceiling, possibly as a warning for the employees to stay put. After Jack abruptly hung up the phone during their conversation, his son Jackie became concerned enough to call his mother Jo to inform her about what was going on. Jo advised Jackie to call the police while she headed to Jack's office, and when she arrived, she discovered Jack lying on the floor and attempted to use her sweater to plug the gunshot wound on his neck. It wasn't long before the Ypsilanti Police Department arrived at the scene, and while Jack was unconscious, he was still alive, so he was rushed to Beyer Memorial Hospital. He was subsequently transferred by helicopter to the University of Michigan Hospital, but Jack never did regain consciousness and passed away just over 14 hours later during the early morning hours of January the 12th. The crime left everyone perplexed, as even though the office's safe was partially open when the two gunmen entered, nothing was stolen from it. What made the murder even more brazen is that Eamon and Greenstreet was located across the street from the police station, and a number of local cops had actually purchased insurance from Jack. Since the two perpetrators had left three living witnesses behind and made no attempt to conceal their identities, it was theorized that they were not from the Ypsilanti area. Based on the witnesses' descriptions, composite sketches were circulated for the two gunmen, but they could not be identified. On the surface, it appeared that Jack had been the target of a professional hit, but since he was a well-liked member of the community with no criminal record, and investigators could not find anything in his background to suggest he was involved in illegal activity, no one could figure out the motive for the crime. However, according to those who knew him, there were a number of signs that something was bothering Jack, and he seemed to be visibly depressed prior to his death. One issue which appeared to be causing Jack great stress was that his daughter Tammy was planning to get married in March, and he did not believe he could provide her with the lavish wedding he had hoped for. Also, according to his ex-wife Jo, Jack had told her that his marriage to his current wife Anne was on the rocks. The previous summer, Jack had supposedly asked Anne for a divorce, and while they managed to mend fences for a while, Anne had asked him for a divorce at Thanksgiving, though things were in a holding pattern, since Anne had spent Christmas in Grand Rapids caring for her ailing father. As far as I can tell, Anne never publicly commented on these divorce allegations, but she did share a story about an incident which occurred after she and Jack attended a Christmas party several weeks before his death. Jack had gotten pretty intoxicated at the party, and while Anne was driving them home, she claimed that Jack started rambling on about knowing some important, powerful people who had done something wrong. He then mentioned writing down their names on a list and putting the list in a safe deposit box, and when Anne asked Jack what he was talking about, he said it was safer for her not to know. Of course, since Jack was drunk at the time, Anne did not take what he was saying all that seriously, but following his murder, she began to wonder if Jack knew some incriminating information about certain people which led to him getting killed. This prompted Anne to start searching the residence to check if Jack may have hidden a key to a safe deposit box, but she could not find anything. Anyway, it was common practice for Jack and his brothers to meet every Tuesday night for a poker game, which was played in the back room at Eamon and Green Street. On January the 10th, the night before Jack was killed, his brother, Norm Brown, showed up there and noticed that Jack was speaking on the phone inside his office with an unknown individual and seemed quite agitated and upset. When the call ended, Norm asked if everything was all right, and Jack said it was nothing, he just had a couple of problems he needed to work out. Jack then said he couldn't participate in the poker game as he needed to leave and meet his wife at the Briarwood Mall in Ann Arbor. This was the last time Norm ever saw his brother alive, and in retrospect, he wondered if Jack's phone call might have been connected to his murder. It would also turn out that on the very same day Jack was shot, a major drug bust took place in the area, which was supposedly triggered by information that was provided to the police by an anonymous informant. This led to speculation that perhaps Jack was the informant and had been murdered in retaliation, but investigators could not find any connection between the events. During the spring of 1984, after Jack's family and the local Chamber of Commerce offered a $15,000 reward for information, the lead detective at that time, Joe Condren, said that he received a very interesting tip from an anonymous male caller. While Condren would not reveal specific details about this tip, he said the information the caller provided was so compelling that he told him he was willing to pay him $1,000 up front to share everything he knew, and the rest of the reward would be paid out if there was an arrest and a conviction. The caller told Condren that he would think about this offer and call him back, but he never did. The case would receive national exposure when it was featured on an episode of Unsolved Mysteries, which aired in September of 1989, but this failed to bring the investigation any closer to a resolution. Sadly, Jack's first wife, Jo, died in June of 2014 at the age of 75, and three of their four children have also since passed away. One of Jack's sons, Clark Brown, took ownership of Eamon and Green Street following his murder, and another son, Jeffrey Brown, worked as vice president there for many years. But Clark died in March of 2016 at the age of 58, while Jeffrey passed away in January of 2023 at age 55. And Jackie Brown, who had been conversing with his father on the phone right before he was killed, he died in December of 1994 at the age of 34. But we'll be talking more about him later on. But after 40 years, the two men who were responsible for Jack's murder have still not been identified, and the crime continues to remain unsolved. So I guess you could say the trail went cold. I've been fascinated by this case ever since I saw it on Unsolved Mysteries nearly 35 years ago, and since it was filmed during the show's second season, there's a real feeling of authenticity when it comes to the presentation. Not only was the recreation of Jack Brown's murder filmed in the actual Eamon and Green Street office, but a number of real people from the story, including Jack's wife Anne and his brother Norm, play themselves during the reenactments and interact with an actor portraying Jack, which I'm sure must have been a surreal feeling for them. Perhaps the most interesting example of this involves a man named Darwin Dutch Jordan, who was vice president of the realty office at Eamon and Green Street, and one of the three employees who was locked inside the bathroom by the two gunmen after they murdered Jack. I'm sure this was a traumatic ordeal for everyone involved, so it's pretty remarkable to see Dutch Jordan reliving this experience by playing himself during the reenactment. Dutch passed away in March of 2015, but if you look up his obituary online, it mentions his connection to the Jack Brown murder and features an interesting quote from his daughter, Lindy Hunt. Quote, "It was one of the big questions in his life he never found out the answer to. It wasn't so much who that bothered him, it was why." End quote. Indeed, the main reason this case is such a head-scratcher is that no matter what Jack may have done, what could have compelled two men to walk into his place of employment in broad daylight and shoot him in front of witnesses? They also committed this crime without wearing masks, and even though there were three other people who could have positively identified them, the perpetrators let them live. This suggests to me that since they weren't too worried about being recognized, the two men did not live in the Ypsilanti area and may have been brought there by someone else who hired them to kill Jack. But while I've seen this crime referred to as a professional hit, there are many details which make me think these guys were amateurs who were incredibly lucky to have gotten away with it. In addition to leaving three witnesses alive, it seems crazy to me that they would target Jack at his office when it was located across the street from the Ypsilanti police station, which suggests that they were not all that familiar with the area. They also only fired one shot into Jack's neck and did not make absolutely certain he was dead before they left, as he wound up holding on for another 14 hours before he passed away. What's also unique about this case is that even though we have living witnesses who saw the murder, their accounts only make things more confusing. They claim that when the two men arrived, Jack said, quote, "We have trouble here," and instantly ended his phone call, which would seem to indicate that he knew who these guys were and why they were there. And of course, we have the gunman's cryptic line, quote, "You think you're pretty smart, don't you?" that turned out to be the last thing Jack heard before he was shot. When Jack replied, quote, "Well, maybe," did he know what this guy was referring to? Or was he just as confused as everyone else? Like I mentioned in the intro, aside from the Unsolved Mysteries segment, there isn't much information out there about this case, aside from a handful of old newspaper articles. But there are a lot of unsubstantiated rumors which can be found online in various comment sections and message boards, and if any of this information which has been shared is true, it could shed some light on the circumstances of Jack's murder. However, before we talk more about that, let's first discuss the known facts of this case. It really does not sound like investigators were able to uncover anything in Jack's background which could shed any light on why someone would want to kill him like this. Given that he owned a real estate and insurance office, you could easily assume he was using it as a front for illegal activity, such as money laundering, but there's no evidence that this was anything more than a legitimate business, and two of Jack's sons would continue to run the office for many years afterward. So if Jack was involved in criminal activity or made enemies with some dangerous people, he kept this very well hidden. But there were definitely warning signs that something was bothering Jack, such as the agitated phone call his brother Norm witnessed him having on the night before he was killed. Now, it's very possible that this phone call was a personal or business issue which has no relevance to this case, but since Jack turned up dead the following day, Norm may have found it more ominous than it really was. I know this was 1984, so I'm not sure if the Ypsilanti Police Department had the necessary technology back then, but I'd be curious to know if they were able to check phone records for Jack's office and determine who he spoke to that night. Before he left, Jack told Norm that he was meeting his wife at the Briarwood Mall, and given that there were supposedly issues in their marriage at that time, perhaps this was the source of his stress during the call. And since we just mentioned Anne, what are we to make of the cryptic comments that Jack made during their car ride together about putting the names of important, powerful people onto a list and placing them inside a safe deposit box? I know that Anne later felt like kicking herself for not pushing Jack for more information about this, but at the time, she just felt it might have been nothing more than drunken rambling. And for all we know, maybe that's exactly what it was, as no evidence was ever found to indicate that Jack put together a list like this, or even rented a safe deposit box. Or alternatively, if there was some legitimacy to what Jack was saying, perhaps he just never got around to making this list before he was killed. If Jack did have dirt on anyone, it obviously didn't save his life. The other major angle which was pushed forward on Unsolved Mysteries is that a major drug bust had taken place in the area on the day of Jack's murder, thanks largely to information which was provided by an informant. So perhaps Jack was killed because he was the informant, or alternatively, someone was just under the mistaken impression he was an informant. They show a snippet of a newspaper article about this drug bust during the Unsolved Mystery segment, but the image is not clear enough for me to read it, even if I freeze frame. And unfortunately, I could not find any additional information about the drug bust in the newspaper archives. Without further context, I can't offer much insight into whether or not it's connected to Jack's death, but it seems like a long shot to me. Again, investigators could not find anything in Jack's background to suggest he was involved in illegal activity, and even though the bust was made possible by information provided by an anonymous informant, where would Jack have obtained this information, and how would the killers have known he ratted them out to police? Remember, his murder took place at 11:10 in the morning, and while I don't know the exact time the drug bust occurred that day, this seems like an awfully quick turnaround. I have seen some other alternate theories pushed forward, such as Jack being the victim of mistaken identity, given that Jack Brown is a very common name. However, one hole in that theory is that the gunman immediately approached Jack's office and never asked him his name before he shot him, so I get the impression he knew exactly who Jack was. An article about this case in the February 13, 1985 edition of the Detroit Free Press also pushed forward a rather outlandish theory that since Jack was supposedly quite depressed, he staged an elaborate suicide and hired these two men to come into his office and shoot him. In response to this, the lead detective, Joe Condren, stated, quote, "Anything's possible, but for everybody who says Jack was depressed, there's somebody else who says, hey, Jack was on top of the world," end quote. Okay, so now it's time to address some of the uncorroborated rumors I've seen posted online, and we'll start with the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online forum, which I'm always referencing. There's an interesting thread there about this case, containing comments from some posters who claim to have a personal connection, and one of them was none other than Jack's first wife, Jo Greenstreet Brown, who started posting there in February of 2010 under the username JV Bro. She described Jack as a quote-unquote player with women who drank too much, but was otherwise a good guy. The most interesting new tidbit she shared is that at the time of his death, Jack apparently only had $18 in his bank account, which could indicate serious financial problems which may have played a role in why he was killed. It's been reported that Jack was flustered over the fact that he might not be able to provide his daughter Tammy with the type of lavish wedding he thought she deserved, and if he only had $18 in the bank, that would certainly explain why. Joe suspects that even if Jack didn't personally know the identities of the two men who killed him, he did know why they were there. She also made mention of a conspiracy theory involving Eastern Michigan University, which is located in Ypsilanti, and I'll talk more about that momentarily. Now, Joe passed away in 2014, but in recent years, there have been a couple of other interesting comments in that same thread from a poster under the username Turnbull, who claims they were living in Ypsilanti when Jack was killed, and also alleges that there was some friction at that time between Joe and Anne. I find that comment interesting because in the aforementioned February 1985 article from the Detroit Free Press, it was Joe who shared all the information about how Jack and Anne's marriage was on the rocks and she was planning to divorce him. But the article also stated that Anne could not be reached for an interview, so we never got to hear her side of the story. I know that the Unsolved Mysteries segment did not mention anything about Jack and Anne's marriage being in trouble, other than her being annoyed with him because he got drunk at the Christmas party they attended. And it sounds like Anne was pretty dedicated to finding out the identities of Jack's killers and seeking justice for him. I'm not sure if Anne really was planning to divorce Jack, or if these alleged issues between her and Joe have any relevance to the murder, as it's not like either of these women were named as potential suspects. But it only makes this story all the more confusing and complicated. Anyway, so the supposed conspiracy theory I just mentioned involving Eastern Michigan University is related to the Eagle Crest Resort a hotel/conference center/golf course, which was built in Ypsilanti in 1989 on some land that the university had acquired. Since Jack ran a real estate office, Joe speculated that he may have known incriminating information about illegal activity associated with the acquisition of land for this project, such as kickbacks, and it wound up putting his life in danger. I think the main reason this conspiracy theory has picked up steam is because of a blog post from November of 2009 at an old archived website called emutalk.org, which apparently discussed shady activity surrounding the university. Jack Brown's name was mentioned a few times in the comments section of this blog, including one poster under the username Full of Questions, who claimed that Jack was their grandfather and wrote, quote, "I promise you that these rumors aren't just rumors. Ypsilanti is a shady place, and it makes me happy knowing that other people are aware of it too. I would just be cautious when dealing with certain people around here," end quote. Well, no further context was provided about these statements, and given that Jack's murder took place over 5 years before the Eagle Crest Resort was built, I'm really not sure what kind of incriminating information Jack could have known at that time, which would compel someone to have him assassinated at his office in broad daylight in front of witnesses. I'm not sure I put much stock into this whole scenario, but one theory that frequently pops up online, which I find a lot more compelling, is that Jack's murder was connected to something that his son Jackie was involved in. I've seen this theory brought up during the Unsolved Mysteries message board post from Turnbull, as well as a blog called markmaynard.com. The author made a blog post about this case in March of 2012, and if you look at the comment section, you'll see multiple posters claiming that they grew up in Ypsilanti and heard the same rumors about Jackie. In fact, one poster under the username Sherry wrote, quote, "I'm not sure you heard this rumor that this hit was meant for the son, also named Jack Brown. The son was into drugs and owned a construction business. My parents had hired the son to do some renovations to the garage, and he asked for 10%, and you guessed it, he never came back to do the job. Food for thought," end quote. Now, I'll add the disclaimer here that since Jackie has never been publicly named by law enforcement and is no longer around to defend himself, you should take all these rumors with a huge grain of salt. But that doesn't mean I don't find this theory intriguing. I have no idea if Jackie was really involved in drugs, but he did pass away in 1994 at the young age of 34. I get the impression that he took a different path than his brothers, Clark and Jeffrey, who wound up following in their father's footsteps and working at Eamon and Green Street, and his sister Tammy also worked there as a realtor as well. And even though the Unsolved Mystery segment never mentioned who Jack was speaking with on the phone right before he was killed, it was very interesting to learn that it was Jackie who was in the hospital at that time for some sort of unspecified operation. If Jackie was in trouble, then this certainly adds additional context to his father's line, quote, "We have trouble here." If Jack legitimately had no idea who these two gunmen were or why they were at the office, then it seems weird that he would abruptly hang up the phone without even telling Jackie what was going on. Jack's decision to hang up could be construed as some sort of attempt to protect his son. When the gunman said, quote, "You think you're pretty smart, don't you?" and Jack replied, quote, "Well, maybe," this meant he may have had an idea that these guys were somehow connected to his son, but he just didn't know the specifics about what their issue was or what they were going to do. But getting back to the mistaken identity theory, since Jack happened to share the same name as his son, could it be possible that the two gunmen were hired hands who were told to travel to Ypsilanti to kill someone named Jack Brown, but wound up killing the wrong Jack Brown? It's also interesting how when his father ended their call, Jackie soon made a frantic phone call to his mother, who told him to call the police. Even though Jack had mentioned trouble before hanging up, he didn't specifically say anything about guns or his life being in danger. For all Jackie knew, his father could have simply been referring to some angry customer who came into his office to complain. So perhaps Jackie immediately had an idea about what was going on and believed that Jack was in danger and the situation was somehow related to him. But if Jackie did have his suspicions about who killed his father, it doesn't sound like he ever told the authorities, perhaps because he either feared for his own life or did not want to admit he was embroiled in illegal activity. This is why I would be very curious to know about Jackie's actions or movements following the murder, and if he ever gave off any signs that he knew more than he was letting on. Once again, I hate to throw Jackie under the bus and potentially smear his reputation, since law enforcement has never cast any suspicion his way, so maybe all these rumors about him have no truth. But given how little sense this whole crime seems to make, I can understand why people would be intrigued by this theory. The whole situation is actually a bit reminiscent of the 1976 murder of Stanley Grizek, which was also featured on Unsolved Mysteries and episode number 87 of The Trail Went Cold. As you might recall, that was another case in which a man was murdered by two unidentified individuals in what appeared to be a professional hit. But much like Jack Brown, Stanley Grizek had no known history of criminal activity, so it's been theorized that he was killed because of something his deceased brother was involved in. In the Grizek case, it appeared that a third party had hired two people to commit this crime, and they subsequently left town after it was over, which is why they were never positively identified or caught. I've always wondered if the same thing happened here, as an unknown person may have hired two killers to pay a visit to Eamon and Green Street and kill Jack Brown, but since these individuals were not from Ypsilanti and subsequently left the area, no one recognized them, and they managed to stay clear of law enforcement. There's always been speculation that there were people out there who may have had a pretty good idea of what happened, but were too afraid to come forward. I'm certainly intrigued by the anonymous tip that Detective Condren received during the spring of 1984, where he was willing to pay this person $1,000 in advance to share everything he knew before they decided to break off all contact. I can only imagine what this man said, which could have been so intriguing. Regardless of whether Jack was killed because of something his son was involved with, or if he was specifically targeted, I have a feeling there's a lot more to this story than what has been shared with the public. Given the age of the two gunmen, they would probably be in their late 70s to early 90s if they were still alive, so I'd say there's a good chance they are no longer with us anymore. But if this was a murder-for-hire plot, there may be others who set this crime in motion and have yet to face justice. Whatever the case, even if no one could be prosecuted for this crime, it would be nice if Jack's surviving relatives could finally get some answers about what happened. If by chance you happen to have any information about the murder of Jack Brown, please contact the Ypsilanti Police Department at 734-483-9510. That's 734-483-9510. So now we're going to take some time to talk about another murder which took place in a real estate office 5 months before Jack Brown was killed, only this time it involved three victims and occurred in Houston, Texas. And what's also notable about this crime is that it happened on Friday, August the 19th, 1983, only one day after the greater Houston area was hit with Hurricane Alicia, a Category 3 hurricane with 115-mile-per-hour winds, which claimed a total of 21 lives and caused $3 billion in damage. But in spite of the recent chaos, the three victims here decided to go to work as usual at the Shoemade & Company Realtor's Office, a firm which was located in an old Victorian house on Memorial Drive just off of Texas State Highway 6. The firm was owned by 54-year-old Elizabeth Shoemate and specialized in selling houses in the $200,000 plus range, and Elizabeth's husband, Charles Shoemate, also ran an oil field equipment sales business out of the same office. On this particular day, Elizabeth would be joined at the firm by two of her sales agents, 46-year-old Joanne Brown and 60-year-old Frances Ivy. At around 6:30 p.m., a temporary employee decided to stop by the office in order to check her work schedule, but was horrified to discover the bodies of Elizabeth, Joanne, and Frances lying in the reception area. All three victims have been shot in the back of the head at close range, and Elizabeth had her hands bound with a nylon Venetian blind cord from one of the windows. The police and paramedics were summoned to the firm, and while Elizabeth and Joanne were pronounced dead at the scene, Frances was still alive, so she was rushed to Herman Hospital, where she passed away at around 10 p.m. It was initially reported that nothing had been stolen from the office, but it turned out all three victims had been wearing various pieces of jewelry such as watches, rings, bracelets, and earrings, which were worth a combined total of around several thousand dollars. While some of the jewelry was missing, other pieces were found scattered throughout the office in such places as trash cans and beneath chair cushions, which seemed to indicate that the women had taken it off and attempted to hide it before they were killed. While investigators performed a search of local pawn shops for the stolen items of jewelry, none of it was recovered. According to Charles Shoemate, he had last spoken to his wife on the phone at around 4 p.m. There were no signs of forced entry, so it was theorized that the killer or killers had entered the office shortly before the staff was scheduled to lock up at 5:30. Charles claimed he did not know of anyone who might have had a grudge against him, his wife, or any of the other employees, and could not understand why the office was targeted, stating, quote, "In a real estate business like this, we'd be hard-pressed to dredge up $3 in cash at any one time. You don't keep cash on hand in this kind of office," end quote. In addition to her husband, Elizabeth left behind a daughter, while Frances left behind a husband and two daughters, and Joanne left behind a husband, two daughters, and three stepdaughters. Unfortunately, the Houston Police Department did not have much in the way of evidence to work with, as no one reported hearing any gunshots and no bullet casings were recovered from the scene. However, based on the evidence, investigators believed that at least two different types of weapons were used and there were multiple perpetrators involved. Two witnesses eventually came forward and claimed they had seen a suspicious-looking man standing outside the realtor's office on the day of the crime, and while a composite sketch of this man was created and released to the public, he was never identified. Police have publicly expressed their suspicion that one of the perpetrators might have been a woman, though they never offered any specific reasoning for why they believed this. At some point during the 1990s, the case achieved national exposure when it was featured on an episode of The Oprah Winfrey Show, where the original lead detective, David Calhoun, and some of the victim's surviving family members appeared as guests. But unfortunately, this did not lead to any new breaks in the investigation, and it once again faded from the spotlight. However, the case eventually wound up in the hands of Sergeant Richard Rodriguez of the Houston Police Department's Cold Case Unit, and in February of 2020, he told the media that he was hoping to perform new forensic testing on the Venetian blind cord used to tie up Elizabeth to see if it could turn up any traces of the killer's DNA. DNA testing had previously been performed on the cord in 2006, but did not produce adequate results, so Rodriguez was hoping to secure funding to have more advanced testing performed with better technology. But this is yet to take place, so after more than 40 years, the murders of Elizabeth Shoemate, Joanne Brown, and Frances Ivy continue to remain unsolved. So while I would love to do an individual podcast episode about this case, there just isn't much information available, and it's crazy to me that the story is not more well known. I mean, I've covered a number of unsolved crimes involving multiple people getting murdered inside a public workplace, such as the Austin Yogurt Shop murders and the Florence Salon murders and the Las Cruces bowling alley massacre, and there's usually no shortage of available material in these cases. But here, other than some coverage on an episode of The Oprah Winfrey Show during the 1990s, it seems like this crime hasn't gotten much exposure at all outside the Houston area. It sounds like everyone had nothing but glowing things to say about the three victims, Elizabeth Shoemate, Joanne Brown, and Frances Ivy, so it's been hard to figure out who would have had a motive to want them dead. For all we know, perhaps only one of these women was specifically targeted, and the other two were simply in the wrong place at the wrong time. Obviously, with such limited information available, I can't spend much time formulating theories about what happened, but there are a number of intriguing possibilities. I do have to wonder about the timing, as this crime happened to take place just one day after the greater Houston area was ravaged by Hurricane Alicia. Even though the Shoemate & Company Realtor's office was still open for business, it's reasonable to assume that a number of other businesses were closed or unoccupied that day, and like any natural disaster, I'm sure there were probably looters out there who wanted to take advantage of the situation. But even so, a real estate office seems like a very unusual target, as it's not a place where there's ordinarily going to be a lot of cash on hand. Yes, if robbery was the motive, the killer or killers did get a decent haul from stealing some of the victim's jewelry, but unless they had been scoping the place, how could they have known in advance that three women wearing a lot of jewelry would be there that day? And since the victims managed to hide some of their jewelry before they were killed, the responsible parties obviously didn't spend a lot of time searching the office before they fled the scene. I also previously mentioned that the office building was actually an old Victorian house. I've watched some of the contemporary news footage in order to see what the location looked like back in 1983, and were it not for the Shoemade & Company sign next to the road, you could easily assume the office was a private residence rather than a business. It really does not seem like an ideal place to pick at random if you want to commit a robbery. So this makes me wonder if the victims were targeted for other reasons, and stealing their jewelry was just an act of misdirection in order to give off the false impression that the crime was a robbery gone wrong. But what would be the motive? Well, since Elizabeth was the owner and had been tied with the Venetian blind cord, whereas Joanne and Francis were not, it's easy to assume that she was the intended target. It is worth noting that her husband Charles also ran an oil field equipment sales business from the same office, but investigators have never indicated that they believe it had any connection to the crime. They have also never pointed suspicion towards any of the victim's spouses or family members, but I thought I should mention that there was a bit of a controversy after Francis's husband, E.H. Ivy, was informed about what happened. As you recall, Francis was still alive when her body was found and did not die until hours later, so E.H. called his family minister, Reverend Joe Crosthwaite, and asked him to visit the crime scene in order to administer last rites to Francis. Well, not surprisingly, the police did not want to allow Reverend Crosthwaite into the office since that could have contaminated the scene and compromised potential evidence, so the Reverend was later forced to push his way through several officers in order to deliver last rites while Francis was being carried on a stretcher to a helicopter. When E.H. Ivy heard about this, he became outraged and complained to the press, stating, quote, "When they refused to let Father Joe administer to my wife's spiritual needs, I just thought it was absurd. This is a case of priorities, and it looks like they put the victim's needs at the bottom of the ladder. I don't care if all the evidence was ruined, if one soul or one life could be saved." End quote. Well, from today's perspective, I can see how that might look a bit suspicious, but you have to remember that this was way back in 1983, and I doubt that a bereaved husband whose wife had been shot is going to place too much priority on preserving forensic evidence. So I'm sure this was probably just a frenzied, knee-jerk reaction from E.H., and he wasn't trying to intentionally sabotage the investigation into his wife's murder. So here's the one part of this case where I would like to learn additional details. Nearly 4 years ago, the Houston-based TV station, KHOU, produced a news segment about this case and interviewed Joanne's daughter, Patty Piper, who remembered that at the time of her death, her mother was in a rocky marriage and was planning to leave. Well, from reading Joanne's original obituary, I can tell you that she was not married to Patty's father at the time, but was instead married to another man who had three daughters of his own from a previous relationship. I mean, I don't know anything about this man or the marriage or how bad it really was, and law enforcement has never suggested that there's any credence to this theory, but could Joanne's estranged husband have been angry enough about the potential end to the relationship that he arranged to have her murdered at her workplace? Was Joanne the intended target, while Elizabeth and Francis were just collateral damage? Well, without knowing more information about this situation, I can't say for sure. The only real lead we have are eyewitness sightings of an unidentified man who was seen hanging around outside the real estate firm that day, and while I completely agree with law enforcement's assessment that multiple people were involved in this crime, I would be really curious to know what has compelled him to state that one of the perpetrators might be a woman. We do have a composite sketch for the man, so I wonder if these witnesses also saw a woman hanging around the firm, but just didn't get a clear enough look in order for a composite sketch to be created for her. Or another possibility is that investigators know more about this crime than they're letting on and might have their own suspicions about a specific man and woman. After all these years, the best shot we have for solving this case might be to perform more advanced forensic testing of the Venetian blind cord to see if the killer's DNA is on there. Now, from the interviews I've seen in recent years with the lead investigator, Sergeant Rodriguez, it almost sounds like he's biding his time and waiting for the right opportunity to test the evidence. You've probably heard of Othram Incorporated, a Texas-based lab who over the past few years have used forensic genetic genealogy in order to solve a number of cold cases and identify dozens of John and Jane Doe's. In May of last year, the Houston-based TV station, KPRC-TV, produced a news segment which profiled this case and discussed Othram's advanced DNA technology. After watching it, you would think it would be a no-brainer for Othram to perform new testing on the Venetian blind cord, but at the end of the segment, they revealed that this particular case was not yet in Othram's hands at that time. I'm not sure if there's been any progress on this front, but here's hoping that Othram gets to this case eventually and possibly paves the way to a resolution. In the meantime, if you happen to have any information on the murders of Elizabeth Shoemate, Joanne Brown, and Frances Ivy, please contact the Houston Police Cold Case Unit at 713-308-3618. That's 713-308-3618. Or you can call the Crime Stoppers of Houston tip line at 713-222-TIPS. That's 713-222-8477. But if you just have your own thoughts about what happened, feel free to leave me a comment or send me an email to robin.warder@icloud.com. That's robin.warder@icloud.com. Another reminder that The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so please visit patreon.com/thetrailwentcold to learn how you can support our podcast and become eligible for some pretty neat rewards. Over the past 5 years, our Patreon page has released over 60 exclusive bonus episodes, which are all currently available in our archives for our patrons in tiers 2 and 3. This past month, I actually released a bonus episode about the 1981 murder of Rhonda Hinson, which is technically our podcast's very first edition of The Trail Revisited. I covered this case all the way back on episode number 4 nearly 8 years ago, but since I've learned a ton of new information in recent years, I decided to take a fresh look at it and put together an all-new episode. I've also dropped an exclusive bonus episode from my spin-off podcast, The Path Went Chilly, in which myself and my two co-hosts, Jules and Ashley, discussed the 2006 disappearance of Maureen Fields. And for our patrons in Tier 3, I've recorded another new audio commentary track, which can be played over a classic episode of Unsolved Mysteries, and we now have nearly 60 of these commentary tracks in our archives. I'd also like to give a shout out to our most recent listeners who have signed up with us on Patreon this week, and they are Emily DG, Tim G, Orion G, Donald G, Robert P, and Melinda M. Thank you all so much for your support. And before I bring this episode to a close, I'd like to play a promo for another true crime podcast, Foul Play.
Gather round, friend, and join me by the fire. I have a secret to share. When I was a child, I lived with my grandma. She allowed me to watch Unsolved Mysteries. Fast forward to 2008, my freshman year of college. A series of armed robberies on campus escalated into a serial rapist's reign of terror. That's when I created my first crime podcast. In January 2014, I picked up the podcast again from my college roommate who fell for an underage girl online, to the chilling story of a murdered nun in 1969 Baltimore, and in the Throwaway series, I share my own journey of overcoming homelessness and how that experience led me to unmask a serial killer and identify three of his Jane Doe victims. This is Foul Play Crime Series, where the stories are real and the truth is waiting to be discovered.
I wanted to remind everyone that The Trail Went Cold has once again been booked to appear on Podcast Row at CrimeCon UK next year, which is taking place in London on September the 21st and the 22nd. If you would like to purchase tickets to the event, please visit their website at crimecon.co.uk and use our specialized promo code COOL24 to get a 10% discount on tickets. Once again, that's crimecon.co.uk and the promo code is COOL24 for 10% off tickets. I just wanted to give another shout out to my supporters at the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit and the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online forum, which have a number of interesting discussions about the Jack Brown case. I need to provide a big thanks to Miguel Foote, who edits and assembles this podcast together for me, and Vince Nitro, who composed the eerie music you hear on every episode. If you haven't already, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or leave us a rating or review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. So have yourselves a great week, and join us again next Wednesday for another brand new episode of The Trail Went Cold. ¶¶